Hello, and welcome to the Tech Dirt Podcast. I'm Mike Masnick.
The world is increasingly technological, so we have better get methodical. Bringing precision to critical digital journalism with the singular vision of a modern monocle. Stopping the copyright bullies from pulling the wool on us. Facing and taking on all the blatant hate and trolls. Document the ways that they aim to take control. Scrutinize and do their lies and make them fold. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get hurt. So grab a shovel and dig up the tech dirt. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get hurt. So grab a shovel and dig up the tech dirt.
If you listen to this podcast, then you already know that I spend quite a lot of time thinking about online speech, and as part of that, online spaces and online communities and sort of how they exist and how they work. One large aspect of that is how just different communities govern themselves and how they act and all sorts of things along those lines. A few years back, I put together almost as something of a joke in response to a provocation from Daphne Keller, a test suite of online communities, which was designed for anyone who was looking to come up with policies for how to regulate online communities to sort of run against a test suite, because everybody always thinks of just Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube as sort of the end all be all of online communities. And as I was putting together that list, I sort of realized how many different types of communities there are and how different many of them work. In that list, I had things like Wikipedia and Reddit, but you know, those are communities that devolve some amount of power to the ends of the network. But also I looked at some smaller communities. There was like Guitar Masterclass or Magic Cafe or even very, you know, specific communities like the knitting site Ravelry, which is actually fascinating. There are all sorts of ways that communities can form and operate. And in a digital world, the very systems by which those communities form and how they are managed can change an awful lot about how those communities actually exist and what sorts of norms exist within them. That's part of a key focus, I think, of a new book from University of Colorado at Boulder assistant professor Nathan Schneider entitled Governable Spaces. I should pronounce that carefully. I still can't say it right. Governable Spaces, with the subtitle Democratic Design for Online Life, which is a look at the very different ways that communities form and exist and are governed. And also how we might think about making different online spaces more democratic in some form or another. Somewhat miraculously, just days after someone told me about the book and I downloaded it because it's available as open access, I met Nathan in person. We were at a conference together and he was giving a keynote on the topic of his book. So it made it very easy to then ask him to come on the podcast. So Nathan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mike. It's really good to be here.
So there's a lot to discuss in the book and just in general about like online communities and how they're governed and how, you know, how sort of democracy in theory could flow through them or doesn't flow through them. Starting with like, you know, and I don't mean to necessarily go through the book bit by bit, but, you know, in the intro to the book, I know you use this comparison of your mother's gardening club versus online spaces that you sort of helped to govern. And I thought that was a really interesting and useful framing for how you think about online spaces. So do you want to talk about that comparison and sort of, you know, why you put that at the top of your book?
Yeah, it was really what the moment that made me realize, oh, this is a story I really want to go more deeply into and understand, where I was dealing with a very normal crisis in a large mailing list that I was the admin of just by virtue of having helped kind of co-started the email list. I had the kind of godlike admin powers over it, and one person was being kind of a jerk on it, and people were pressuring me to do something about it. And I just realized, like, what is a legitimate decision for me to make here? Especially since this was a community of people building cooperatives on the internet. So I was very concerned about making sure to do this in some kind of democratic way, and realized just how poorly equipped the tools of this very standard email list were for doing any sort of democracy. And at the same time, I was talking to my mother, not nearly enough, but I try to do my, be the best son I can. And she was telling me about the garden club that she had just been elected president of in her neighborhood, and describing the bylaws and the processes that, this decades old garden club operates by. And I found myself feeling really jealous. Wow. Like, I wish we had in this online space the kinds of structures that she had in her garden club, where I could feel some kind of legitimacy and know the scope of my authority actually was. And so since then, I started thinking about, started realizing, like, oh, wait, none of the online spaces I'm in has caught up to my mother's garden club in terms of, like, the basic structures of, like, an organizational, a healthy, fairly democratic organization. And then that got me on the question of why is it that the logic of the garden club, which is so, like, her garden club's bylaws are, like, the same as bylaws of thousands and thousands of organizations everywhere you look. Like, there's nothing particularly unique about them, but why is it that model of kind of civic organization didn't translate online? And for all the participation and engagement and kind of bottom-up creativity we get in online spaces, why we don't have these kinds of democratic structuring that have become so ubiquitous in an organization as simple as a kind of neighborhood garden club?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me, and certainly, one of the things that struck me in reading that section and reading through other parts of the book was, just sort of the personal experience I had of just, like, you running, the mailing list and me running TechDirt. In the early days, we had effectively no structure for managing the comments on TechDirt. And we're still, pretty free hand in terms of that. But I remember sort of our first real troll in the early 2000s, since I've been around forever. And it got to the point where they were trolling, and I was like, the trolling is fine. But at one point, they actually, it was in a trolling fashion, and I do not think it was a serious threat, but they were talking about killing people. And it was extremely uncomfortable. And it was the first time that I think I deleted, flat out deleted a comment. Thankfully, back then, like, comment spam was not a thing. That's how old this was. Now, of course, TechDirt automatically deletes about, 5,000 spam comments a day. But I remember just feeling bad about the whole process. And it's like, what do I do about this comment? And actually, like, going to lunch with a friend and basically having the same sort of, struggle of, I feel like it's a community. Like, I feel like it's not my position to come in and do something. And the person I was having lunch with, just a friend from college, who said, well, if you're worried that you're sort of taking on the community role, why don't you set up a system of community voting and just let people vote on stuff, which eventually led to, actually pretty soon after, we had developed the system, which I still think is somewhat unique in anywhere. Like, lots of sites have voting up and down, but we always had this system of three different things that you can vote for. You can vote for a comment to be insightful, funny, or you can report it. And at certain thresholds, different things happen to those comments, though we don't reveal the threshold. So that part is not particularly democratic, but the actual voting is is democratic. And so now that's like a huge part of our site, which has a sort of democratic element to it. But, you know, but I don't know if I thought of it in the same way until I was reading your book.
Well, there are so many respects in which online spaces have tried to marshal and succeeded in marshaling the collective intelligence of people, right, which is kind of what a good democracy is supposed to do as well, right? It's a collective intelligence machine. And often platforms have been designed, whether it's, you know, something like Facebook Upvotes or, you know, the /dot system or what right. you just described, or, you know, there's, you know, Reddit. There are all kinds of ways in which systems have been designed for this. And I think there's a lot of lessons to learn from that. And you know, when I talk to, for instance, like old cooperative businesses, I'm often drawing lessons from right. the internet. I'm kind of going the other way, you know. But what's missing in, you know, in these online spaces generally is, you know, a distinction I make with Seth Frye, a colleague of mine, between affective voice and effective voice. Mm-hmm. And this is like the most embarrassingly academic distinction ever, right? Change one letter, everything changes, right? You know, it's angels on the head of a pin. But the difference is affective voice is I can express myself, you know, mm-hmm. I can, you know, be heard, or I can make a lot of noise. Effective voice is like voting in an election, right? Or sitting on a jury, you know, your decision actually changes something fundamental,
right?
And at the highest level of power. And that's what's missing. And, you know, you can see why, how this kind of effective voice did not come into play, really because of the structure of, you know, the server-based internet. Right. And here we might get into some of these questions about protocols and platforms yeah, that yeah. you've, you know, written on, which is, you know, which is when you're running the tech dirt server, you are responsible for what sits on that server. You right. know, you can, you know, the law can come after you, and you can unplug the server. And this goes back to the earliest online communities in BBS, is these bulletin board systems where people, you know, would often run them out of their houses as a hobby. And they thought of it as like inviting people over to their house. You know, you're right. a guest in my home, you play by my rules. And there's a lot of reason for that. And often when you look at that early history, there were democratic experiments, like, for instance, Lambda Mu was a famous case yes. where after the, you know, the great, you know, quote unquote rape in cyberspace that was the subject of a famous Village Voice article in the 90s. They instituted a kind of voting system on policies in this early text-based online community. And then ultimately, like Bell Labs, which owned the thing, was like, you know, wait a second, the server's sitting in our office.
Right.
You know, we have to have veto power at least. You know, they started realizing like, because of the structure of the server and the structure of the legal organizations that own the server, you know, we can't actually give you that effective voice in the way that a garden club can, as right. being like a nonprofit organization that is, you know, based around membership. And so in some respects, this this technical design of the internet converged with a user experience design built around what I call implicit feudalism, which is everything is designed yeah. around the kind of autocracy of the admin. And then it became a business model, right? It became yep. Implicit feudalism went from being just like a way of, you know, solving problems on servers to like, oh, this is a business model, even a way of incentivizing free moderation, right?
Right?
When you look at subreddits, for instance,
yes,
you know, people aren't paid to do the work of moderating these subreddits, except in power, you know, and right. this became a kind of proxy for money, and it enabled these platforms to scale. So the, you know, the book starts out by exploring the way in which this norm that emerged first, like very sensibly in these early spaces, got built into the user experience, got built into our interfaces, and then, you know, built into the logic of you know, some of the largest business models in the world.
Yeah. And I'll admit, so when I was reading and like, you know, the first chapter of the book is about this implicit feudalism. And I have to admit, when I saw the term, I sort of winced a little bit, because I've seen the term sort of like, you know, digital feudalism or something used in discussion of online communities in the past, and I haven't liked it. And so, you know, I like it better the way you use it, because I think you're using it in a slightly different way and makes sense in the context in which you're explaining your thinking. But it worried me in sort of the, I guess the sort of like the implicit like negative that is associated with feudalism that comes along with it.
No, absolutely. And I've lost a lot of sleep over this term myself. I'm a medieval history junkie, and it pains me a little bit every time to use it. And I see it getting used a lot. Usually feudalism is talked about in terms of like the economic structure of you know, like the big tech companies are the feudal lords and that sort of thing. Sort of in what I'm saying. But I'm really focused actually on the structure of everyday communities.
Right.
But you know, we have to be careful about that term, because feudalism was like essentially an insult concocted by like the French Enlightenment to imagine a fake vision of what preceded it. In fact, like, you know, medieval society was full of some really interesting governance structures and some interesting democratic processes. Like, the election of the Pope, you know, is a really interesting mechanism designed for a kind of quasi-democratic process. But that negative connotation, I think, is important to pick apart, because I think there is value in that idea of like the home, of recognizing that, you know, you're coming to my space, like my rules. And in some cases that's really appropriate. To me, the goal, when we talk about like, what's the normative goal, it's not to replace, you know, all of the admin and mod run spaces with like, you know, the bylaws of my mother's garden club.
Right.
You know, to me, the hope is actually to have a much more textured variety of governance possibilities. And, you know, I think of, for instance, like the stack that makes my computer run, right? Like I'm, you know, crazy, so I like running Linux. And and I think of like the governance stack there. There is, you know, Linux kernel, benevolent dictator for life, Linus Torvalds. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, to make it useful for lots of different hardware architectures, the Debian project, which is one of the rare actual constitutional democracies out there, which is an old, large open source project that enables like lots of people to participate. It's very slow and conservative, but it is a really, really critical piece of infrastructure for making the internet work. Right. And then on top of that, you have Ubuntu, which is a startup that takes that mess of Debian and turns it into a product that companies can actually rely on. And then on top of that, I use an operating system called Pop OS, which is made by a company, System 76, that's down the road from me in Denver. And I get to go visit them and talk to them about how it's going. And because of that layer of, you know, of a kind of autocracy plus a democracy plus a startup plus a small business, you have this kind of like variety built in and a resilience. And so to me, the goal is not replacing the one size fits all with another one size fits all. It's a vision that, you know, among other things, my collaborators and I have called modular politics, a world in which, you know, a kind of system paradigm in which we could actually design the governance of our online spaces in a way more tailored to each space and to its needs. To have much more expressiveness built into how we could allow power to flow in our online spaces than we currently have. And the implicit side is, I think a lot of us don't recognize how constrained our governance environments are online and how few options we have.
Yeah. And I think that's true. And I think that's, you know, the book is really interesting in sort of highlighting a bunch of these things and demonstrating different ways that the things can happen. I think one of the other things that struck me in reading the implicit feudalism chapter, and even the following chapter, which is, you know, the homesteading chapter, was that, you know, I come out of it with this fear that, like, gosh, what if people just want feudalism, right? Like, you know, and this conversation comes up all the time in different contexts when we're talking about, especially right now, with all of these new entrants effectively in sort of community and social media in particular, where, you know, there are these opportunities out there that are in different ways more democratic and more, you know, more power to the ends of the network, more protocols, not platform based, all this stuff that, like, we appreciate from, you know, for a variety of reasons. And yet people are just like, you know, fuck it. You know, Meta comes in with Threads and that's good enough for us. And so there is this element in my head of just like, what do we do if people just want the sort of, you know, the coziest thing, you know, the most autocratic, who will take care of them best sort of situation. You know, does that mean that these ideas that I think both of us are interested in are like purely academic? I don't know.
No, I mean, I really think it's a question of what is most available, right? I mean, one can bend over backwards and do these things democratically today. You know, I 5 years ago co-founded a Mastodon server called social.coop, and yep. You know, and it's made me love social media again, but it kind of took 5 years of like democratic practice to make it happen. We had to like hook together a bunch of different platforms in order to do democratic processes. Is, you know, it just made me, making that work made me realize how hard it actually is to do this stuff in these kinds of ways. And I don't think it needs to be the case. And you know, when you think about something like a garden club, the people who are founding that garden club, probably they weren't like governance nerds. They clearly just copied right. those bylaws from somebody else. And because they look like bylaws everywhere else. To me, the goal is, how do we make it so that when somebody's just starting a group, you know, and they want to just build a community to do stuff together, you know, something like democracy, or at least a path toward democracy, is a kind of easy default setting that's at least an option. And today, that's really not the case. And when you look at these you know, these protocols, you know, like, for instance, the Fediverse, or Blue Sky, or these sorts of things, you know, which I'm, you know, really interested and really involved in, the implicit feudalism logic is still there largely. Like,
yeah.
You know, to run a Mastodon server, you need, you know, some degree of technical skills. The server is all set up to give all power to the admin. Yep. There really aren't structures built in to support democratic practice. So when we try to operate democratically in social.coop, we're often feeling ourselves as working against the defaults of the system. And actually, you know, another case that is quite polarizing, but is, you know, to me has been really instructive, is around blockchains, which yeah. is a kind of protocol that, for better or worse, has been built around the assumption that these should be collectively governed in some way.
Right.
Bitcoin is effectively collectively governed by its miners, Ethereum by its stakers. You know, there's a lot of caveats to all that, but it at least introduced the problem of collective governance in a way that server-based online services never really did. And as a result, you have an outpouring of like product development around governance. Right. So, you know, nobody in that space will say that they've solved the problem, but millions of dollars have been spent creating really cool interfaces to make like voting with tokens easier. And, yeah. you know, one thing people are doing now is actually merging that with social networks so that you have, I think it was actually the morning we had our conference. I was looking on my phone, saw the first token vote on embedded in a social network in Farcaster.
Yeah.
And I just thought, okay, this is the beginning, you know, where democracy is entering into the social feed. And in not just like complaining about a presidential candidate or whatever, but actually like having effective voice and voting within a social feed. You know, that to me is suggestive that when you have a space where collective power is real, you know, where there is true stakeholdership, where there's a kind of true citizenship, suddenly governance becomes a problem. And then the challenge of trying to solve it in a really fun and inviting way, you know, becomes real. Otherwise, I do think we have a tendency to drift into accepting the kind of authoritarian logic of our systems. And I argue in that second chapter that you know, we're drifting there, that actually people like Mencius Moldbug, you know, the kind of monarchist blogger, is kind of the most honest political thinker we have right now, because he's recognizing, look, let's just take what we're doing in our online systems and apply it to politics. Like, right. Let's just embrace monarchism that we're already practicing and not admitting to. And that to me is, you know, is actually not an optimal outcome. We're going to lose, you know, the real collective intelligence that we can get from democracy. We're going to lose all kinds of justice when we actually start behaving honestly and line up our political imaginations more fully with our social practice online.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of, going in the opposite direction, I think, of what we want. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting, right? And there is something that I've been sort of trying to think through too. And you know, part of, you talked about Farcaster and what they're doing. And in the book, certainly you talk, you know, a fair bit about things like DAOs, right? These, you know, and I think it's interesting how you look at things like DAOs and the ability to have, you know, voting and democratic participation in making decisions and really, you know, no sort of central authority, you know, setting those up other than, you know, the code, I guess you could argue is the central authority. It's interesting to me how many people these days react so negatively to that. Right. You know, and obviously some of this has to do with the nature of blockchain, cryptocurrency, utter scam nonsense that has flown through that entire space. And yet there is this element, and this was something I just kept thinking about through the book, where it's like you have certainly people who think about, you know, democratic values and ideas like co-ops and social values in that sense. And yet those seem to me to be the very same people who are most annoyed by, angry at blockchain, DAO concepts. And I can't quite put my finger on why people react so negatively to that. And I don't know if it's just like the currency part that connects into this. But do you have any thoughts on why it feels like a mismatch to me?
Yeah, I think it is actually that currency sense, and it goes deeper. It's a culture that has taken hold in that context that sees financialization as like the solution to social problems, right?
Right.
And this is something I've written about and, you know, been very vocal about in the crypto community. And I think I've succeeded, you know, to some degree in moving people, you know, getting people off that ledge a little bit. You know, for instance, I've, you know, had dialogues with Vitalik Buterin on this topic, the founder of Ethereum. We did a book together, you know, he's responded to my work, all these things. And, you know, my claim there is that you cannot, you know, is that that culture has relied, has believed with a very kind of old libertarian, you know, fiction that you can just solve social problems with financial incentives
right
alone. And, you know, anybody with a kind of like social orientation, right. solidarity orientation is going to see this and think, this is insane. Right. Why would you think that? And so there is a lot of like recoiling against it. You know, what I think, the tragedy for me of what's lost there is this is actually a design space, an opportunity to create a kind of different foundation upon which to build organizations
right.
that actually does meet a lot of goals for solidarity focused people. I mean, our other alternative is to rely on a legal system based on violence and prisons
right.
As the basis of incorporating organizations and borders, by the way, right?
Yep.
You know, I've worked with digital co-ops for many years. They have tons of problems building networks across borders. And that's one reason I'm really interested in, you know, in crypto. And these technologies can be developed in ways that are less reliant on financialization to solve every problem. At the same time, I do think there is some value in economic incentives as a tool yep. alongside other tools. To me, this stuff has gotten so insanely polarized. And I think,
yes.
you know, I got into it very early. I was never a maximalist. You know, I always felt like this is very scary stuff, but it has some very powerful potential. And we have to hold that tension in mind. And if we could just get over the idea that this is either going to save the world or is the worst idea ever, we yeah. could recognize like, no, there's some interesting possibilities here. We need more people with more imaginations working on it. And above all, it is a chance to build in a kind of native stakeholdership to our networks that is not ultimately reducible to, you know, the US corporate law that is not ultimately reducible to what you can enforce in a US court and instead enables us to, to build forms of, you know, of organization that, you know, that are native to the networks that we increasingly inhabit. But, you know, I wouldn't, you know, the claim is not let's put all of our eggs in this basket.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's funny because I'm from a slightly different direction, but I'm sort of coming to the same conclusion where it's, you know, to some extent, like this goes back to I remember when I was studying economics, how like there's this desire to put everything in terms of like dollar value, you know, users value it this much. And, you know, as I took more economics and began to realize, like, I think one of the biggest mistakes economics ever made was like putting it, like figuring everything out in terms of dollars, because then we make this assumption that, you know, anything that you can value in dollars can be exchanged for dollars. And it's like, that's not quite how it works. Like people's values are not entirely interchangeable with money, but you know, I think the crypto world treats it that way. And if we had a better realization of like incentives matter, but not all incentives are one-to-one translatable to money.
Yeah.
Is like a really important thing. And if we understood that as in, you know, just this more, this structure of incentives matter and societies matter, then you could do some really interesting things and DAOs being a really interesting space. But right now it still seems, you know, the monetary aspect of it, the currency aspect of it just gets in the way often.
Oh yeah. And I think honestly, like people are learning those lessons to some degree. I mean,
yeah.
for instance, you know, after our discussions, Vitalik Buterin introduced this idea of soulbound tokens, not a perfect idea, but the idea of a token that gets kind of permanently attached to a user
right.
so that it's not tradable. And so for instance, a more recent DAO that actually incorporated as a co-op called Collabland is one of several examples that have used this soulbound token as a token of membership that alongside the financial token, the tradable token. So they
right.
try to meet this balance between like the financial incentives and also like person-based membership. I think that people are learning those lessons and realizing, you know, it's now pretty much, you know, understood in the DAO community that like pure financial token governance is like a dumb idea because everyone's been burned enough. But there's so many, you know, I also draw a lot on like feminist economics, right? Which is, you know, a legacy that takes many forms, but really stresses, turns away from a scarcity-based approach and tries to see how can we support and enable human flourishing? How can we center like the goals of the human rather than like the goals of the system? How can we recognize under-recognized labor, you know, real deep attention to what labor the market is not recognizing and seeing, and to find ways to honor that labor and to reward it and to provision for it. And so I found this to be a really helpful corrective to be able to still talk about and think about economics, but not within this kind of like dreary tradition that sees humans as kind of like maximization robots.
Right. And so I'm curious what you think. We've talked, you know, you've mentioned a little bit about, you know, the Fediverse and, you know, what you've done with your instance. And we've talked a little bit about Farcaster. We're in this interesting time right now where like there is all this new experimentation. In fact, that was what the conference we were at was looking at, all these sort of new different approaches to decentralized social media. And I'm kind of curious what your take is on how that's going in terms of like specifically on the social media side, and where do you think that's heading, given, you know, given what you're thinking about?
Yeah, I think this is such a critical moment, and it's a scary moment in a lot of ways. You know, I think more, you know, I'd love to, you know, explore this more with you, but you know, I love protocol-based approaches and like the vision of decentralization, but I'm deeply skeptical of it because I think protocols are so capturable, right? Mm-hmm. They are so vulnerable, especially because they don't have governance and economies built in of their own. And so those who do have those things, like corporations, you know, have the ability to capture them. Again, I think that's something interesting about the crypto world is that these are protocols that actually do have governance and economies built in potentially. You know, I think, you know, I tend to think, you know, from an analysis I did of like moments of decentralization in tech, you know, kind of internet history, I started to recognize that actually decentralization always occurs in a polarity with centralization. Like the two are inextricably bound. Like we shouldn't think of it as a choice between one or the other. We should think of it as where do we put one and where do we put the other?
Right.
In the same way that like you can't have a kind of open, you know, corporate market without antitrust enforcers. There's like a big, powerful centralized stick that's able to keep the market decentralized by like beating down the capture.
Right.
And so to me, this is the crucial moment where we ask, where are we going to build what I call accountable centralization to protect the good decentralization that we want? And that also requires us to ask, which kinds of decentralization do we actually want? And I love how Blue Sky kind of compartmentalizes the stack and invites us to ask like, okay, which parts of this stack do we actually want to decentralize and which ones are okay to be centralized, which ones and how do we want to do that centralization? So, you know, to me, this is crucial because right now, you know, Meta is coming in with Threads into the Fediverse, and that is one play for, you know, here's how we could centralize part of this network, right? You know, and, you know, and then on one hand, I think that's very exciting because I, you know, I'll probably have a better chance of like being able to interact with friends if, you know, Threads is there. But at the same time, like, I want to make sure that we have the accountable centralization that can really counteract the power of a company like Meta. In the context of Blue Sky, I think they're doing some really interesting technical work around what the stack could look like, but I don't see the organizational work around, okay, how do we make sure that we have really accountable organizations that are built into this ecosystem, that are, you know, the kind of, where are the Wikipedias? Where are the, you know, the anchors that are really value centered, that are public good centered, that are going to help counteract the power of profit seeking interests in these spaces. And so I think it's a moment where we need, you know, really serious investment in creating the kind of trustworthy entities that can help the scaling occur, that can help right. counterbalance, you know, the kind of narrow self-interested forces that, you know, normally are probably fine in that ecosystem,
right.
But that need a balance. So this is the critical moment to be asking, ironically, in the context of decentralization of decentralized networks, how and where do we need to centralize on our own terms?
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting. Last year, I wrote this paper, which was, I forget the title that was put on it. It was like Decentralization and All the Things. But I think that's the eventual title. But which is kind of ironic, because the point of it is that is almost exactly what you're saying, where decentralization and centralization go together. And you sort of have to realize where each one is needed and how one benefits the other. And the choices that you make of what to decentralize versus what to centralize are the most impactful choices. And because there are advantages to each of those, which is basically what you were just saying. And part of what I argue in that paper is that, you know, when you're thinking about protocols instead of platforms, is that if you start thinking of the protocol itself as centralization and all of the things that you build with it as decentralization, that's one way of approaching it. And that was sort of my suggested approach coming out of that paper.
And then the question is, how do you make sure that protocol is accountable,
yes.
right?
Yes.
As opposed to becoming a kind of tool of the, you know, of
right.
you know, capture actors some, on the network, right?
Exactly. And there are different ways to approach that, but it is important to think about that and to approach that, fully understanding what it is that you're going in with, which I think is really interesting. That's a really, I mean, you know, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about Blue Sky and AT protocol in particular, and sort of how they're structuring things. And I do think you're right. I think the way that they've sort of abstracted out each of the different layers is really interesting and sort of gives us a chance to get away from the sort of mastodon approach of, you know, sort of like mini feudalism or whatever it is, to something more interesting. But there are still really, really big questions about governance there and how that works and how it'll, you know, how it'll grow as well, which gets into it.
To me, that comes down to, you know, how money flows. And this is where, you know, the part of the argument that I'm, you know, making on the one hand is like, okay, let's explore some user experience designs and like, how do we build systems and, you know, how do we operate as communities and that sort of thing. But, you know, the questions get bigger too, because, you know, one lesson, for instance, for me from the DAO context is mm-hmm. once again, as with the web, a decentralized tool set has produced centralized outcomes. And right. why is that? You know, any large DAO today, you know, that's doing big things, like, for instance, you know, the DAOs behind, you know, some of the stable coins or the exchanges, like these are controlled by venture capitalists now.
Right.
And that's, these are the same people who control Web2 who were able to gain power on the protocol of the web.
Yes.
And this is because there are certain rules around how capital can allocate and be, or can aggregate and be allocated, in, you know, without sending people to jail in the United States, and in, you know, other countries where capital tends to gather. And we have allowed this optimum of venture capital to become, in many respects, the only story. And, you know, venture capital is just one tool. Like, it was illegal until around 1979, at least for pension funds to invest in it. It was a choice that we made to say, this is how we want, this is a thing we want to allow to happen. And I think we can allow other things to happen. And so, you know, to me, ultimately, or not ultimate, but in a critical sense, we cannot get, you know, the democratic internet that we want just with tech tweaks. You know, we really need to also be asking questions and developing, you know, really policy tools, unfortunately, you know, because the law is driving a lot of this, including, you know, among the crypto libertarians, they're still, you know, really, really structured around US law. And we need to, if we want collective ownership of some sort, collective stakeholdership, we need to enable the development of means of financing that can actually produce these outcomes. And this is something we really don't have. It's something we can do. In a few periods in history, we've done it with rural electrification. For instance, in 1936, like, we basically solved rural electrification. My grandfather grew up in a, you know, in a, on a farm with no electricity until a rural electric cooperative was enabled to form there by, you know, federal law that gave, you know, real bank rate loans to, you know, farmers who wanted to form co-ops. And we can do this again for democratic technology. We just, you know, we have those lessons in our history. We just have not applied them to this context yet. And to me, that is a really critical piece of the puzzle. If we are going to really counteract these sources of power, we need to have the financial tools to do it, because it's really financial tools that are driving the centralization. It's, you know, the web is a decentralized protocol. You know, blockchains are decentralized protocols in all sorts of ways. You know, the Fediverse is decentralized protocol. The reason why so many people are on Threads, you know, and why Threads is going to eat the Fediverse alive under current conditions is that Threads was able to grow with, you know, with access to massive stores of capital. And we need to be honest about that, that our technical aspirations have to be paired with a kind of political economy.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating how much of this discussion just gets back to, like, the inherent tension between, you know, economics, technology, law, and people. Like, it all comes back to people and society and how people interact with one another. And that's often forgotten in these discussions, where people sort of think that everything can be solved with new laws, new technology, you know, and it is more complicated than that. And so, anyways, I, as I said, like, I think it's a really great book. It's really, really thought-provoking. Obviously, hopefully everyone who's listened to this conversation realizes, like, they're, you know, listening to what you have to say, the book is really interesting in getting people to think about how communities should be structured and how we could structure them better and differently. And so I really recommend it. Again, like, you can buy a copy, but there are, you know, buy a physical copy, but there's also open access. You can download it. The book is Governable Spaces, Democratic Design for Online Life. And my guest has been Nathan Schneider. So thank you so much for joining the podcast and having this discussion, and for writing the book as well.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Mike. It's thank you for your work in these areas as well.
Cool. And thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next week. To grab a shovel and dig up the tap. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get hurt. To grab a shovel and dig up the tap. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get hurt. To grab a shovel and dig up the